surely. And I think you remember a book of mine published in 1996 describing a Luciferian ceremony within the precincts of the Vatican. And remember that the Vatican, the Pope, has in its entourage, he has a chief exorcist, we all know him, Father Gabriel Amort, and there are eight employees, exorcists. They work both in Rome and Milan and Turin. So there is a lot there. What we've just seen, the crack has opened, and we've seen one effect of it. Put it like this, Art. For somebody in my position, from what I know of how this institutional organization works, it is impossible that there be a triple death by violence within the precincts of the Vatican, amongst Vatican people, unless it is impossible that should happen without demonic interference. Because the thing is so, should be in principle, so sacrosanct, and so preserved from such activity that it might take place outside, but not inside.
I was there. I was in the Vatican. And to contemplate that occurring is almost beyond...
I know. I realize fully how it has impacted you, as we say. But my word to everybody is, we won't know the details for a long time, if ever, in our lifetime. Wherever you go. Just as other assassinations that took place in the Vatican, we haven't got the details yet.
What the Vatican is its own sovereign state, is it not?
Absolutely.
So that the investigation, the details of it, the suspects, the people who would be caught, and then I have no idea what would happen in the Vatican if they came up with suspects. How are things handled in the Vatican?
Oh, they have their own way of dealing with that.
So Italian law in no way bears on the Vatican.
Now, normally, let's take a banal example. If somebody is found inside in the Vatican Museum trying to make off with a valuable chalice or something,
yes,
they of course, put him in the Vatican prison, which they have, and they call in the police. And he's, you know, a normal thing like that.
And they are turned over to Italian authorities.
Yes, they are. Normal evil. Normal violence.
Normal evil, yeah.
Normal. Anything which... really comes from deep within and betrays the presence of the, betrays that footprint again, and this does, that's dealt with in camera and dealt with away from the prying eyes of the media and of the world. It's impossible for them to hide everything, and very early on we all knew, very early on in this incident, we all knew that something had happened, but the race in the various news media, the CNN, NBC, ABC, CBS, to try and get some substance to what they were hearing was fantastic to watch. Of course, nothing came out because the Vatican has means of choking off everything.
Well, the pressure on the Vatican from the media over this is going to be big.
It is going to be big.
And do you think they will just hold their silence?
They will, but there's always the inevitable tipster, the inevitable sale of news. And that's what will probably happen.
I would imagine that Catholics all over the world, which look to the Vatican spiritually,
yeah,
will want to know if their spiritual capital is under siege.
That's right. And then, you know, Art, there's another consideration which is painful for me anyway, because I'm a papist, as you know, in spite of the fact that I have my criticisms of the Pope. I've served with the Popes I didn't serve with, and I have strong critiques of the present Holy Father, who is my Pope. But I have strong critiques of it. But on another plane, this is a dreadful slap in the face to John Paul II. because this happened under his watch. No matter how you cut it, he's the boss. He's in charge.
So really, it works in the Vatican like it works in Washington.
Yes, it does.
Good economic times, the president gets the credit. Bad economic times, the president gets the blame.
Exactly. Oh, yes, it does. And you see, it does reflect on his administration. It does reflect on the spirit he has installed now for almost 20 years, as Pope. And a lot of us have been saying all along, for a long time, there is a spirit of secularization going on in John Paul II's Vatican, which makes possible such incidents as this, and other incidents too, which have not come to light. So it must be a cause of great anguish to John Paul II.
I'm certain that is so, but you're saying even the what I would think of as relatively small moves, because it looked very non-secular when I was there, but these small moves would invite in the possibility, you're saying, of what has happened?
Yes, they do. They do. The old Italian saying, which I can't quote any longer in the Italian because I forget it, is that any crack in the wall and the wisp of Satan enters, the wisp of evil enters. And there is a process of a gentle process. The intention is ecumenical. The intention is to be like the rest of the world. The intention is not to be so remote. But there is has been a tendency in the pontificate of John Paul II to be so accommodating. Let me give you one example. No pope, believe you me, Art. No pope of the 263 popes before him would have sat down with the leader of the voodoo priests of Haiti, which he did.
He did.
And he said to them, look, Father Maurice, I think Maurice was the name of the head of the voodoo expert priest in Haiti, look, we are interested in your religion and you should be interested in our religion. That is something which is unheard of in Catholic tradition. Or John Paul II himself has gone to a secret island off the Malagasy Republic, where he drank from the sacred water, from the sacred fountain of the god, of the local god worshipped. He sat in a phallus-shaped chair in India and had the mark of Kali put on his forehead.
Oh, my God. Father, hold
that
on.
That is something which, violates.
Oh, listen, are you suggesting that the present pope may himself be under...
No, I'm suggesting that he has drawn on himself demonic attention, which he could have avoided.
All right, Father Malachi Martin, hold it right there. That's plenty, thank you, to digest for the moment. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM.
Do you know when the national debt will become the national disaster that will force the United States of America into bankruptcy? Does a bankrupt America mean personal bankruptcy for you?
His wife shot another man who shot them, committed suicide. All of this inside the walls of the Vatican, the killing, the first inside the walls of the Vatican in our living memory. I guess there may have been 150 years ago something may have happened. And we were talking about that before the break. Just an incredible, incredible occurrence. And Father Martin began to say that Pope John Paul, I think this bears repeating and trying to understand, Father, Pope John Paul has been in some way affected himself.
It must be a cause of great anguish for him.
Well, you said that, but you said that he went to a voodoo, and I'm not really caught up on this, Father.
Well, he went to Haiti.
Haiti.
He had a papal trip to Haiti. And during that trip, he met officially with the head of the, I think it's 15,000 voodoo priests that live in Haiti and sat down with him. We have the photograph that I have here in my files. And one of the things he said was, with typical John Paul II ecumenism, look, we are interested in your doctrine and we think you should be interested in our Catholic doctrine.
How?
I know. At least it leaves you speechless.
That's right.
Or, for instance, in years that passed, when he went to India, John Paul II permitted a young lady in a sari to put the sign of Kali on his forehead with that red stain. And he sat in a chair chosen by the Indian bishops, which had the phallic shape. As you know, the phallus is worshipped in Hinduism.
Why?
These were actions of John Paul II destined to create a great fellowship and feeling. For instance, let me give you an example which struck us all at the time and is not mentioned because people are afraid of being called anti-Semite. John Paul II went for the first time as a pope, he went to the synagogue in Rome. The head of the synagogue is a very respectable rabbi called Elio Toaf, very well known to all of us. And they sat on a stage, or a bema, as they call it in Hebrew, on two chairs, sort of catty corner, facing themselves and facing the audience. And in his speech, which is a very good speech, by the way, a very good address, John Paul II said his only reference was, oh, by the way, you know, our founder was of your race. That's all the testimony to Jesus that John Paul II gave. And when Vatican held a special Holocaust evening, which was standing room only, it was such a grand affair, with music and with a huge menorah lit by the grandchildren of people who had survived Auschwitz and Dachau and Birkenau, the Hitler camp. In his speech for that particular evening, which was a Holocaust evening, John Paul II consented to have the only crucifix in the hall removed in order not to offend his Jewish friends. We consider that, for me to remark that it's not anti-Semitism on my part, I've done more, I think, for Jewish-Christian relations than most people alive. That's the story you and I have never delved into, which we will ask another broadcast, please God. But the fact we find this, no pope before John the 23rd, before John Paul II, would have allowed it. If a cardinal did that under any of the other popes, the cardinal would be sent away to live life out in a monastery on the top of the Sierra Madre.
Why has John Paul done it?
It is his form of ecumenism. And look, let me make quite clear, Art, for you and for everybody listening, this man is my pope. He does represent Christ. He is the vicar of Christ for me. And if he were to speak under the conditions of infallibility, I will accept what he says. But I am allowed, nay, I am obliged by my tradition and my faith and by previous popes to critique anybody, priest, bishop, cardinal, or pope, when I think they are in error.
So a pope then, the pope, now I'm not a Catholic, my wife is, but the pope is supposed to be, is he not, infallible?
Only under certain conditions.
Help me understand what conditions those would be. In other words,
this, he must state explicitly as follows, put it in my language, paraphrase it but accurately, what I'm about to tell you is something I say as the successor of Peter, and I say it with the authority of Christ as his vicar on earth, to be held by all the faithful as a matter of profound, divine Roman Catholic faith. He must say that. Now, John Paul II has never said that about anything. even about the ordination of men and women.
So then he can do that on the one hand, though he hasn't done it, and on the other can sit down with a voodoo priest.
That's right. And then his famous encyclical, which has become so popular with progressive Catholics, is called Ut Unum Sint, that they may be one. He discussed and outlined the way he would like to take apart the whole doctrine of the Pope's primacy in order to suit non-Catholics. So John Paul II has ventured out along the edges of orthodoxy in his statements and in his preaching. But in whenever he taught, he has never yet taught error infallibly. He's never adopted the infallible mode. The infallible mode is something where the Pope says, I am now doing this as the head of all Catholics. I'm doing it as the successor of Peter, and it's to be held by all the faithful under pain of mortal sin. He has never done that yet.
Do you think he's, of course, very frail now, very old?
Very frail. He's very frail, and it makes you cry to see his face. His left eye is recalcitrant. He can't keep it open or shut. His left hand is jigging continuously.
Yes.
He doesn't look at you straight in the eye because he's bent over. And by the way, I know a man who frequents him about every 6 weeks from New York. And he says that surrounding John Paul II in his court, in his entourage, the hate is palpable.
The hate is palpable. Now, Father, when you heard about murder hours ago in the Vatican, were you surprised?
No.
You were not surprised?
No. No, I'm not surprised. I'm appalled, of course, and shocked, because two people's lives were snuffed out by violence. And but I know that we will, in my lifetime, I may not know the real facts behind it all. And moment of insanity is a beautiful expression in Italian, but tells me nothing about the reality. But surprise? No, I'm not surprised.
Well, when you said that the Pope's entourage, the feeling of hate was palpable, of hate of the Pope, you mean?
Yeah.
Hate of the Pope?
Yes, and this particular Pope. And this man, by the way, is not a Christian.
I beg your pardon?
He's not a Christian. He's a technocrat who goes to the Vatican for a certain reason periodically. And he said you can't mistake the hate and dislike of this man in his immediate entourage. And so John Paul II is a pathetic figure, really. He lives with this night and day. There is no mercy for him. There is no compassion for him in his normal entourage. And he is spurned by the Patriarch of Constantinople, and he's laughed at by the Patriarch of Moscow, and he's let down by his cardinals and his bishops. He's an outcast, this Pope, and it makes me cry to know what he's going through. And yet, he has done things which we must criticize, and will criticize, in all trust and belief that he is our Pope, but has made mistakes. Now, the point in general about these killings, the murder and the suicide in the Vatican, is that my point was that it's in his watch this has taken place, and he knows it. He's a responsible man, and he knows that this has taken place during his watch, and that therefore, somehow or other, he is responsible. He is responsible.
Would you expect a statement from the Pope?
No.
No.
Oh, he might make a reference. Every Wednesday, as you know, when he's at all in good shape, he gives a little sermonette from the window, from one of the windows on the fourth floor of his apartment in the Apostolic Palace, out to the crowd. There always is a crowd on Wednesday to listen to him. He may make some general reference which people will pick up on as a reference to this calamity. Because, believe you me, Art, ecclesiastically, papally, this is a disaster. There's no doubt about it. And this is a sign of the times. I mean,
are we to know, will we know, Father Martin, when the Antichrist is with us?
Yes, we will. We have been given three signs by the scripture and confirmed by all doctrine and teaching for almost 1900 years. It's very simple art. First of all, the first sign, the major sign is this. In his day, I mean, when he's active, because he's here already, but he's not active. But when he is active, there will be problems, human problems, confronting us as a race, as a society of nations. Problems we can't solve.
And we later learned that a guy had died in that house, and he was, alcoholic, and he used to walk up the stairs every night, and you could hear him fall into bed. And my little sister described that. But we were told in the house that we moved into that it too was haunted. And of course we didn't think anything of it, but it was rather interesting when that happened to my little sister, because she couldn't make up that story.
What if, when you die, if you're an alcoholic, your hell is to stay as you are?
What, drunk?
Yeah.
Or restricted to 7-Up for the rest of eternity?
No, drunk. Drunk. Maybe after the first 50 years, after the first several millennium, maybe drunk wouldn't be so good.
Well, I just hope that heaven has at least some single malt scotch.
Well, I can see where you're going.
So anyway, in the house that Mom and I moved into, we were told, because the people that lived there were actually friends of the family, and we were told that the house was haunted, and we said, yeah, ha-ha. Mm. And when you go in the house, it was a typical, like I said, old two-story Victorian house. And
right.
As soon as you walk in the front parlor, there was an immediate set of stairs that went up to the second floor to the bedrooms.
Yes.
And there was three bedrooms up there and a bathroom. And then there was another door in the hallway there that led up a very tight set of stairs up into the third floor attic.
Sounds like a cool house.
Yeah, it was a very cool house. In fact, it was built in the turn of the century, late 1800s, with wooden pegs, no nails in it. So
a lot of them had secret passageways. I lived in a house once with secret passageways.
Never found a secret passageway, but we started hearing noises in the attic. And you could hear a sound like somebody dragging a trunk across the ceiling floor, or across the ceiling.
Oh, yes.
And my mom would come out of her bedroom and she'd knock on my door. Do you hear that? And I'd say, yeah, I hear that, Mom. And so one night I had a friend of mine over, Gus, and we went up the stairs, and it was one of these deals where you pull open the door, and there was a string that hung down from way up above that would pull on to pull a light.
Sure.
And we pulled on the light and nothing happened. The light didn't work. So we decided to go up the stairs and we would take two flashlights. And Gus and I went up the attic stairs and we got up to the top and we each had a flashlight in our hand. And up there was also a roll-away bed, one of those old roll-away beds that folds in half. And somehow, this honestly got happened to us. Both of our flashlights went out at exactly the same time, and my belt got caught on one of the springs on that rollaway bed, and it was like Laurel and Hardy. We both fell down those stairs.
That'd be me, too. See, now, this sounds like a real story to me. Other people chase skeletons. Not me. No, sir. I'm down the steps with you.
We fell down those stairs. And I finally went back up a couple of days later and changed that light bulb. And then I decided, this would be a great place, a groovy place to have my bedroom. I could put my Janis Joplin posters and my Jimi Hendrix posters up here and over here. And
so you did.
And I did. I made a bedroom up there.
Okay, we didn't have a lot of time.
Well, anyway, I'll speed it up here. I started sensing that somebody was in the room with me.
Right.
Things would happen. The car keys would disappear and then reappear.
Mine do all the time.
You could smell flowers. You could smell things. And there was a... At first, it was like a pleasant presence of a... Like, it felt like a feminine presence. And then it became very oppressive. It was like a... I had to move back downstairs.
You had to move out of the room?
Yeah, I had to move out of the attic. It was a great place to have a room at 15 years of age or 16 years of age, but it was...
Haunted.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got you, sir. Thank you. I lived in a... in a very unusual house. We were near a place called Fort Ritchie, Maryland, in Blue Ridge Summit, Pennsylvania. And the Mason-Dixon line actually crossed through our house. Actually crossed right through our house. So you could, depending on what part... We had a lot of trouble with taxes, where we paid taxes. But the Mason-Dixon line cut through the house... And this house was up on top of a mountain. It was a very, very, very large house, 35 rooms. An architecture that my mother called early Halloween. I mean, this place looked like your classic ghost house. And it had secret passageways. When I was young, well, we had a lot of fun with those. And the secret passageways were left over from the days of slave trade when people, Southerners, who were sympathetic to freedom for the slaves, had a kind of a system where they got them from the South to the North. And this house had been one of those houses. And as a result, there were secret passageways everywhere. Behind walls. It was really cool. Wasn't haunted. I never met a ghost there. But as a teenager, I spent a lot of time in those secret passageways. They were really cool. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, this is Brian in Philadelphia, listening to 1210 WPHT.
What a monster radio station that is.
Yeah, I just have trouble getting it where I'm at.
Uh-huh.
At the moment.
People, on the other hand, in Nova Scotia, they're seeing it just fine.
I'm deep in the bowels of a building.
Yeah, I
put the radio outside the door. And
oh, boy.
It's pretty crazy here.
You know, there is a solution for that.
Yeah.
And Bob Crane has got it.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, it's a little tiny FM transmitter. And what you do is hook it up to your AM radio, and it will then transmit on FM in perfect clarity. So you put a second radio inside, and you listen on FM.
So what would you be tuned in under?
In other words, you're retransmitting the AM signal that your radio is receiving outside.
Okay.
And you're retransmitting it on FM. So you just set it to a spot on the FM dial. You've got actually a little transmitter.
Oh, wow.
And it's clear as a bell.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. Anyway.
Yeah. I'm not sure what kind of story this is exactly, but I consider it a ghost story.
All right.
And I guess like most ghost stories, the real creepiness doesn't kick in until the punchline, and it scares the heebie-jeebies out of me.
Go.
This happened about 10 years ago. At 10 or 11, my grandmother died. I was never really particularly close to her. And about 3 days, I was having a lot of trouble reconciling with the grief, and about 3 days afterwards... I had this dream, and initially, if it wasn't for the punchline, I would just dismiss this as a dream.
Sure.
It's one of those dreams where you dream that it's morning and you're waking up.
Oh, I've done that.
I hate those kind of dreams.
I've done that. I've actually done that.
Yeah, it's like the dream pulls a trick on you, and
yep.
You get up and you think you're going about your morning.
That's right.
And there was a knock at the door, at my bedroom door, and my dad saying, oh, someone's downstairs.
Actually, it's disorienting.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's disorienting when you actually wake up and it's still dark.
Yeah, and so, yeah, that's right. And so at that moment, the knock comes.
Yeah, knock, and it's my dad at the door, and he's getting ready to get in the shower, and he's like, there's someone downstairs. And I go downstairs, and there's a buddy of mine saying my grandmother had come to his house and asked to be driven here. And he came in, but my grandmother refused to come in. she was standing out at the door.
Yeah.
And so I go to the door, and there's my grandmother looking older and more haggard than I had ever remembered her looking.
Oh, yes.
And she's in bare feet, and it's snowing, and it was fall when she died. We had had no snow. And she's, like, scratching on the glass. And I, like, go, and I see her, and I'm shocked. And she just says, "Brian, let me in." I just got really, really spooked by that, and I'm, like, just standing there saying, "Come in yourself." And she's like, "No, let me in." And I refused to do that, and finally just went, "You are not my grandmother." And I closed the door on her, and she started scratching on the glass going, "There is no heaven, there is no heaven." And it really, really spooked me out. And I went in, and my friend gave me some kind of comment about, "Man, you're really cold," or something like that. And I went upstairs, and at the top of the steps, there was my father in a dripping wet towel, because he'd gotten out of the shower, and he just said, "Who was that?" And it was his mother that had died, and I just broke down crying, and all of a sudden woke up.
Oh my God.
I woke up, and it was the middle of the night, and I'm just shaking in bed, and I'm like, "Oh man, that was really, really scary." And it bothered me for a couple of days, and I finally decided to mention it to the family.
Yeah.
And when I mentioned it, my father got real, real quiet. And he said, 20 years before, when I was like 3, maybe 4 years old, we had this neighbor that lived next door who would, she was a, this old woman who had never married, and she had gone a little loopy, and her relatives had carted her off to an institution.
Yes.
And my father relayed, he had a dream one night that he heard a pounding on the door, and he got up out of bed, and he went to the upstairs window, and he leaned out, and there was old Miss Esther scratching on the glass, begging to be let in.
Oh, God.
And his only response to her was, "You are not Miss Esther." And he closed the window on her, and he went back to bed, and then, of course, woke up himself. A few days after that, he was at the supermarket, and he ran into Miss Esther's brother, who told her, "Oh, my sister just passed away this week."
Oh, brother.
I don't know what to make of that. I don't believe it was the actual spirit.
Just out of curiosity, Had you let her in, what do you think would have happened?
That is something that has just racked my brain for 10 years. Had either my father 30 years ago or myself 10 years ago actually said, "Yes, come in," the consequences really, really freak me out.
Or worse yet, have you done something sinfully wrong by not letting her in?
Yeah, well, there was just this overwhelming feeling of that is something that is very wrong. It was just, there was an all-pervasive, like when I said to it, "You are not my grandmother," it was not out of fear, it was not out of like, "Oh, I don't want to deal with this." There was a sense of, "This is something masquerading.
I got you, and I can't handle it anymore. Goodbye."
Okay, Art.
Oh, man, scratching at the window. Let me in. Oh.
Mama said there'll be days like this, there'll be days like this, Mama said.
Dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. Or use the Wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
From actually very serious cactus country out here, indeed. I don't think too many programs come from this part of the world, but we do. And this is kind of interesting. From Charleston, South Carolina, which is a pretty spooky place, I'd like to say anyway. Hi, Art. My husband and I loved having this little black cat named Bucky in our lives for 15 years. She was correctly labeled as intuitive, intelligent, funny, and loving by many. She passed away last January. After her death, I instinctively told my husband that we would never find a soul as special as hers if we took in 100 cats. And that's when the felines began inundating us. Well, we took many pictures of the first group of four premature kittens that we bottle-raised, and in the upper corner of one is a fuzzy, cloudy shape that is easily recognized as Bucky, sitting upright with her tail smugly wrapped around her body. We'll send you the picture today. We're now up to 11 new cats and kittens now. It seems an appropriate loving prank that she's been able to play on us after her departure from this life. Kathy and Michael in Charleston, South Carolina. Yeah, I buy that one all the way. Cats are as individual and full of soul as we are. And that may apply to other animals. I'm, as you know, a cat fancier, and so would they make themselves apparent after this life? Oh, yes, indeed. First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Yes.
This is Sterling from Oregon.
Yes, Sterling.
Got a good one. This one happened when I was about 14. We lived in a church.
You lived in a church?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it was we had moved to Alaska to a town, and my dad was a caretaker of this really, really large church, and so we lived inside of it.
Okay.
And they had like a little apartment. It was all attached to the side of it.
Now, one would think a church would be a relatively safe place to live.
Oh, yeah. you would, but no.
No.
It started like, probably 4 months after we got there. You'd hear people like knock on the door. And so you'd go to the door and answer it, and nobody there.
Nobody there.
And they had the typical church doors where, you know, you have the push bar and you have the little window that's probably a foot long and 6 inches wide. So you can look through, you know, and so you shut the door and you turn around and boom, 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 on the door again, and you spin back around, you're looking out through the door, and there's nobody there. And so I'm like, okay. So I started, you know, telling my parents, you know, that really weird things are going on, you know, and they're like, well, you know, just keep it quiet, you know, it's probably just kids playing jokes, you know, and
of course
all this. And so then I started going down one night when it got really bad. It started getting like worse towards the end of the summer going into the winter. It started getting really, really bad. And I walked downstairs. My mom told me to go get my dad. So I was going downstairs one night, and I passed by the youth pastor's office, and I just glanced in. Well, here's this black ghost of a figure, and I said, the only thing I can ever equate it out is, I don't know if you remember the old Equalizer, that show that used to be on TV.
I do.
The Equalizer. Remember how he stood in front of that car?
Yes.
In front of that car in the beginning of the show?
Yes, sir.
Well, that's what this thing kind of looked like.
This is in the counselor's office.
Yeah, in the youth pastor's office.
Pastor's, yes. Uh-huh.
And I would see just kind of this outline of this person, you know, and you could tell it looked like a person, and you could see kind of, I don't know, it's really hard to describe, because you could tell it was a person, you could see his face, but yet it wasn't real distinct. And then he would just kind of be crouched down, and then he would just kind of shake his head like in a no, like no.
Yeah.
You know, and just kind of shake his head and look away.
Yeah.
And then he would disappear, you know. And I saw this guy like, oh man, dozens of times. And every single time after he would disappear, I would think, okay, next time I'm going to ask him where he comes from or why he's here or something, you know. And then a few days later I would see him. And you'd be standing there just going, say something, stupid, and nothing would come out of your mouth, you know?
Yeah, you're in shock.
Yeah, you're kind of like frozen, and my brain is thinking, ask him where he's from.
Yes.
And then your mouth is going, yeah, okay, and you just can't talk. And it just got so outrageous. They had built me a room, because the house was only designed for just a family with no children. So they had built my room off one of the end of the classrooms upstairs,
right.
And that's when all heck tore loose.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the church was kind of in a big octagon shape.
Yes.
And so because of fire code, they had to put a door from our apartment into my room, and then also a door on the opposite side.
Right.
So people could pass through if there was a fire. Well, this door was right adjacent to a classroom, and I'd lay down, oh, I don't know, 1 o'clock or so at night, you know, you'd be sitting there listening to the radio or whatever, you know, like this, and all of a sudden you'd hear just tables and chairs and stuff just being thrown all over the place. Sounded like somebody was demolitioning the room. You know, so you'd go like this. I'd go over to the door, and I'd open up the door, and you'd look, and you think you're losing your mind.
Yes.
There's nothing out of place, nothing going on. You'd shut the door, and then you're standing 6 inches from the door, and the doorknob's rattling back and forth, the door's banging in the latch,
kind
of a loose-fitting door, you know, and it's just going bang, 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 bang,
bang, bang, bang,
like this, and you're like, and
wow.
So you grab the knob, and I'm almost shaking, telling you the story again, because it was such a thing when I, especially being that age, it was just quite a traumatic thing. But you'd grab it, swing it open, and there's just nothing there.
Nothing there.
You know, and it perpetually got worse and worse and worse. Finally, I just wouldn't sleep in that room anymore. I'd sleep over on the living room floor, and then they decided, because the living room was attached right to the kitchen, so then this thing or things or whatever decided that the kitchen door was the door to play with now, and they went to the kitchen door and rattled that all night long.
How long did you have to put up with this?
Oh, my gosh. Well, till they moved me to Wisconsin. They sent me to go live with my uncle in Wisconsin, so I was... Oh, man, it was, let's see, we moved there July of 83, and I left, August, September of 84, so a little over a year.
I got you. All right, well, that's horrible. That's horrible, horrible. The only thing that could be worse would be the special effects you see in horror movies where a wood door bows inward. But, I mean, to sit there shaking with a knob going back and forth, and then to grab it and open it and have nothing be there. I couldn't go through that. Well, once again, you as an audience have outdone yourself, and we have selected 9 brand new ghost photographs sent tonight, this very night, to Keith Rowland, my webmaster. And they're on the website right now. Not 1, not 2, not 5, but 9 brand new ghost photographs. Of varying scary intensity. So you're welcome to go look. They're on the website right now. www.artbell.com. If you don't get in tonight, then get in tomorrow. Wild Card Line, you're on Ghost to Ghost AM with Art Bell. Hi.
Good morning, Art. This is Craig from Northern California, listening to you on KSRO 1350.
Craig, welcome. Speak good and loud for me.
Okay. You and your... callers have scared me pretty good tonight. I was driving down the 101 freeway. I don't know if you're aware of Northern California freeways.
I know about 101. I even know about one, that twisty little thing that goes through the fog.
Yeah, I was coming back from Eureka here back to Santa Rosa from a business trip, and it's, you know, pretty dark out there on the 101, and your callers are talking about red eyes.
That's right.
All these things, and it started burying me deeper and deeper in my seat as I'm driving down the road.
Yeah.
Looking in my rearview mirror, there's red lights, and fortunate for me, it wasn't the supernatural. It was the California Highway Patrol reminding me to slow down. Nice officer didn't give me a ticket. I told him what I was listening to anyhow. But the story that I have for you is as true as I can believe. It was told to me about 10 years ago by a Boy Scout leader of mine. I was in a Boy Scout troop when I was younger, through a Mormon church. This was a Mormon guy, real nice guy. And he took us up to Philmont, New Mexico, on a trek, about an 80-mile trek into the mountains. And we were up above the tree line about 11, 12,000 feet in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And one night we were telling stories, this is about the fourth or fifth night into the trip, and we were all pretty worn out, and he was telling me he's a Hawaiian guy, his name is Alton, and he'd come over to the United States when he was a teenager, and he was telling me this story, him and a friend, when he was younger, about 14 or 15 or 16, I guess he'd just gotten his driver's license, took a couple of girls out on a date. And they decided to scare him. They were going to give him a good scare, so they took him to a cemetery in Hawaii. And, if you know anything about Hawaiian cemeteries, they're very sacred places, and people leave food for the deceased, and you don't touch the food. You don't walk on the graves.
That's right.
Several other things. And so they left the car. They pulled up to the cemetery and left the car and ran around the other side of the cemetery, and we're going to sneak up on the girls in the back of, I guess it was like a 5140, he was telling me, a huge car. And as they came up behind it, they thought the girls were laughing in the back seat. They were, the car was kind of rocking back and forth, and as they got closer, they could tell they weren't laughing, that they were actually screaming.
Uh-huh.
And so they couldn't, they ran up to the car, and at this point, the car was going end on end, side to side. Tires coming after them off the ground the way he was described.
Oh, my.
They finally get the car door open. They couldn't open the door. They tried for minutes, and finally the car stopped shaking. They opened the door, and their girlfriends were frantic, talking about red eyes. There was red eyes just all in the windows, and they were just totally frantic. They got in the car, and they drove home immediately. Well, when they got home, my friend Alton felt some pain underneath his sock. And he pulled back his sock, and there was a bite mark on his ankle.
A bite mark?
A bite mark. And he thought, oh, I must have tripped, I must have hit something. And the next morning, he lived with his father and his grandfather, and his grandfather was an old Hawaiian, kind of like a medicine man, a very wise old man. He was telling his grandpa what had happened. He was laughing about it, and his grandpa said, that's bad stuff.
Yes, it is.
You've got to make amends for what you did, and that is a bite mark that you have. Well, his older brother, Alton's older brother, was in the same room when his grandfather was describing what he had done. And his older brother, really, the way Alton described it to me, disliked being Hawaiian. He disliked his culture and, said, oh, you guys are full of beans, that there's no such thing as those types of things. And that later that night, his older brother had talked him into going back to the cemetery, and Alton reluctantly went. And they ran all over the cemetery, from one end to the other, over graves, kicking over food, the whole nine yards. And when they got back, his brother had a lot of pain, like Alton had felt. And they woke up their mom, and mom came in the room, and he took down his pants, and they counted over 200 bites all over his body. In fact, he had to go to the hospital to have some of these sewn up. And
you're sure of this?
Yes, I kind of have some proof of it. The doctor at this particular hospital, the way Alton describes it to me, was a white man from continental United States, and he was about ready to call the police. He said, look, obviously there's abuse going on in the house. I don't believe your, put up story of ghosts fighting you and such.
Yeah.
So he, in fact, called the local police chief who came out. He was a Hawaiian himself, and he knew exactly what that was from. And, no charges were pressed, but Alton was also bitten again in the hip, and where he needed to have several stitches, and to this day he still has that bite mark in both his ankle, very deep. And he showed it. She showed them both to me. And I mean, they are bite marks. They are teeth marks. You can see the indentations of the individual teeth. And in fact, he says he doesn't have too much contact with his brother to this day. But he told me that in fact, when he talks to his brother still talks about, you know, he doesn't wear shorts because he's embarrassed of the scars all over his legs that he received from that. But
I tell you, even going back in your story to coming up on a car, literally shaking with its tires coming off the ground on each side and girls inside screaming.
Right.
Could I go up to that car? Could I open that door? I think tough luck, girls. I'm out of there.
I think I would agree with you. I mean, he wasn't aware of the folklore until, you know, after, you know, he had talked to his grandfather. I went to Hawaii when I was about 10 or 11, and my family and I had toured some cemeteries, and I remember specifically the guide saying, stay on the path, never touch the food. And it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. You know, people put McDonald's bags with, you know, quarter pounder with cheese next to the gravesites because they believe that the deceased still eat and need food and water and drink, and they need company and conversation.
Well, I can understand that. A good quarter pounder every now and then, here or there. Well, certainly makes sense. Do you have any idea, just out of curiosity, why so many stories like this come from the islands? Why there are so many Hawaiian stories?
Well, you're talking about a culture of, you know, several hundred, if not thousands of years. I mean, we are all mutts from other nations where they had their culture and we were displaced when we came here on boats. You know, those people have, you know, several hundred, like I said, if not thousands of years of written culture and ideals and stories where we really don't. I mean, we're basically the newest country in the world. We're, you know, not even 300 years old, so we haven't really had the time to put together our stories and our folklore and such.
Well, that's true, and it's a good point, and I certainly appreciate your call, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
And the vision of that car rocking back and forth to the degree that its tires are coming off the road, the surface, with two girls screaming inside, that'll be with me for a while. And this whole thing about red eyes, glowing red eyes, it comes up again and again and again when we do nights like we have done tonight. So tonight, when you get home, or if you're on the road, I keep an extra eye out for those red eyes. That's never good. Red eyes are never good. Well, listen, folks, I'm sorry to say that's it for tonight. Don't forget we've got nine new ghost photographs from just tonight on the website, www.artbell.com. Now, tomorrow night, you're going to definitely want to listen, because a good friend of mine, Mike Murphy, who's done the same kind of material that I've been doing for years on KCMO in Kansas City, is going to be filling in. I think you'll find it a fascinating experience. He's going to have Mark Davenport here, and it's going to be a good night. That's Mike Murphy, tomorrow night on Coast. I'm Art Bell for now. Night all. Desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening and or good morning wherever you may be across this great land of ours. Coming up tonight, Ghost to Ghost AM. Nothing but ghost stories all night long, with the exception of what we're going to do here in a moment.
because there is news from Peter Davenport at the National UFO Recording Center in Seattle, Washington. So we will do that, and then we will proceed with the balance of the night in nothing but ghost stories. As promised by popular request, one more night of Ghost to Ghost. So that's all directly ahead. Don't move. Well, all right. Here he comes one more time with me, Peter Davenport, who runs the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, takes hotline calls when stuff is happening like now, and takes online reports when it's happened, you know, a little while ago or in the future. Here's Peter Davenport. Peter.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening.
Always. Good evening. It's great to be here tonight. You know, before the program, I was sort of mentally scrolling through the many...
And through all of this, we were trying to gather some kind of idea, again, what to do. And in the end, what happened was my house was torn apart, literally, boards out of the walls and the floors and holes everywhere, and the freezer taken out of my garage, the door ripped out of the side of my garage to get the freezer out, and no body.
So that creature is in somebody else's hands now, and it may, for all we know, still be alive.
Well, I think it is still alive, because I had some other evidence that I wrote in our book that, in fact, when I went into the garage, I saw some footprints from this small creature going toward the wall, stopping. And I believe it dimensionally shifted. So I believe it got away.
Well, of course, that's supposition on your part. With the freezer gone and with the house ransacked, that part has to be supposition.
Exactly.
But, okay. Let's see, doctor. This has ruined your life, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, you had a practice going?
Yes, I was working as a research physician, a psychologist at the current university that I was at. And that is all gone. My life was taken from me.
And you've been on the run since then, haven't you? You still are basically on the run.
On and off, less now that we've gone public, thanks to people like you. It has lessened some of the problems, other than occasionally we have come up again against some pretty hard times. A year ago, I was shot in a parking lot after giving a lecture in San Diego a few days before. I consider that to be fairly serious.
Well, I'd consider it to be real serious. It sure would keep my feet moving.
With ongoing problems being followed, with ongoing problems with computers being taken down, people's houses being broken into, people being beat up for talking about my information, I'd say it's an ongoing problem.
Yeah, so would I. Robert, how have you fared through this? Have you suffered any of the same problems Dr. Reed has?
Some threats, but a lot of problems with any kind of communication that I have, telephone, cell phones, computer, everything. When I got back from Laughlin, I found that somebody had broken into my place, basically, and taken the top of my computer off and messed around inside. So it's an ongoing problem with these people. What they're looking for or how they're doing it, it's psychological, and it's done to create such incredible amounts of stress.
Maybe they think one of you has evidence that you have not yet talked about or turned over or made public.
Well, that is true. There is one piece of evidence that we haven't talked about tonight. I discovered at the scene in the woods a small metal object that I call the Link artifact.
The Link. Yeah, we've got a photo of that on the website, too.
Yes, and I've had that analyzed and stored away, and I no longer have control of that item. I want to make that perfectly clear that I do not have that with me. But some people think that they can get that information out of me, and they have tried several times.
Mm.
And, again, we have hard evidence that can be viewed, hard evidence that can be seen, that's been looked at by other people, that has been analyzed. but this is some type of a controller of sorts.
All right, you've got a website, and obviously the latest information is going to be up there, and you've finally written a book.
Yes.
Called Link, an Extraterrestrial Odyssey.
Yes.
Would it be all right if I gave that phone number out?
Of course, yes. It's what, $19.95 plus shipping and handling,
right.
And there is a phone number to get it?
There's phone number, 1-800-905-8367, 1-800-905-8367.
And it covers in excruciating detail all of the things that fit in between this story that we've compacted together tonight, and there's a very great deal to be put in there to fill in the blanks. That's in the book, right?
That's in the book, and the emails, thousands of them are, thousands, have been overwhelmingly in support. This information, you know, there's a lot of armchair investigators and all this posturing and nonsense.
I know.
Daniel Sheen talked about how there's so much insight in the UFO community. We're not there to speak to them. We're here to speak to the heart and the mind of the people. And in Laughlin, it was overwhelming. The people just loved it. They were completely supportive, and it was absolutely fantastic.
All right, we spoke in Laughlin to over 700 people.
I heard that, yeah.
And again, some of the hierarchy within the UFO community has postured and has questions, and that's perfectly reasonable. But to deny someone the right to tell their story is not the way to go. Now, I want to thank Bob Brown from the International UFO Congress, who invited us to speak in Laughlin. He's a very gracious man, and he did a good job to give us a forum to tell our story. And again, the people have spoken. They loved the information. They know it's true. There have been hundreds of people who have seen other objects like I've seen.
You know,
have seen other creatures like I've seen.
New people are coming together, people like Jonathan and others, and the idea is to create a unified forum, one conducive to the elements of uncensored communication. We want to allow for a safe place for people to tell of their events and events happening all around the world without character assassination and things of this nature. People should not have to have their lives and their loved ones' lives rummaged through simply because people don't understand or they're afraid of the information like Dr. Reed has to offer to them.
And this is what we are going to be doing. We are gathering a team, a very dedicated team who will help bring my encounter and many others to the world to see, to hear, and to let people witness for themselves what is going on out here. You know, Art, it's no longer a question in regard to whether alien life or extraterrestrial life exists. It's absolutely a fact. And I'm not the one saying it. You talk to people like, for instance, Daniel Sheen is an incredible, brilliant attorney who spoke in Laughlin and talked about creating a new forum where people can create a new world view and prepare for embracing this idea.
And there's many others, individuals like Ron Russell, who studied and researched crop circles, Dr. Lloyd Pye, Dr. Simeon Hine, Larry Warren, and many, many others.
George Knapp, Jacques Vallée, Jaime Masson, Don Ware.
Oh, the list goes on endlessly.
And these are some of the people who have supported me and my issue of taking this to the people. Art, we are going to go to Japan within the next 6 months.
Are you?
And present this on a world forum. And you don't know that I was going to do this, but I want to give you an invitation to go with us if and when you feel appropriate to present this truth to the world.
Well, that's ever so kind of you, but as you know, I am retiring.
And I know that.
And so I'm really happy for you. I hope that, and I trust, frankly, that the Japanese will give it the proper exposure. You may, in fact, if you want to know the truth, you two, you'll be a lot better off with the Japanese media than you will be the American media.
Yes, I am there, Art.
It's an unfortunate thing, Art, when it comes to the reality, to truth, such as what's going on in our weather, as you've talked about a great deal, and Linda Bolton Howe, and Jonathan, and others. It's a reality, but when it comes to the mainstream American media, unfortunately, they attack it.
I know.
They attack it on one hand, and in the next hand, they talk about these incredible things happening.
But that is what happens when we look at things that we have fear of. This does not have to be about fear. This is about hope for all of us. And I personally believe that if we can start to look at this thing not as a fear-based idea...
Well, let me stop you there for a second, Doctor. Let's consider your story.
Mm-hmm.
As I consider your story, I'm not sure that I'm comfortable that it's a warm and fuzzy story, and I'm not sure that I'm comfortable that I should be fearful of your encounter or encounters like your encounter. I'm not sure which it should be. I'm not sure what your encounter tells us about how we should feel about them.
Well, sure. Robert, let's put it this way, Art. In regard to the alien being, which I took to fondly calling Freddy, I was in his presence for hours and hours while he was alive. He never attacked me. In fact, he almost playfully gestured to me. He had the strength of probably three times what I did. He probably could have torn me apart just with his muscles, but he was extremely gentle. This was an intelligent creature. The ones we need to be afraid of may be within our own camp.
Yeah, no kidding. Like the ones who went through your house.
Exactly.
I'm with you there. Well, all right, so all of this is in your book. Again, it's called Link, an Extraterrestrial Odyssey. I take it you've not turned it over to Amazon.com yet, or have you?
Not yet.
Okay, well...
Need to be done. Can I give out the website address?
Yes, you may.
www.odysseylink.net.
And we've got a link on our website right now, as well as the photographs. And the phone number to get the book, which is the only way I guess you can get the book right now, right?
Well, there's one other way.
All right, well, let me give the phone number.
It's
1-800-905-8367. That's 1-800-905-8367. Or you can write, I guess. Is that right?
That's right. We now have a newsletter, which is brand new, for people who do not have computers. And there are a lot of them.
Yeah, there are.
And all they have to do is write to the word link, L-I-N-K,
right.
P.O. Box 16007, Seattle, Washington. The zip is 98116.
All right, let me give that again. Link, P.O. Box 16007, Seattle, Washington. Zip code 98116, right?
That's right.
All right, well, we're out of time. It's not enough time to have done a follow-up on this, but I'm glad we got to do it. I did hear a few new things tonight. I had no idea the alien had been that apparently friendly.
There's so much more to say, and perhaps we'll have the opportunity to do that with your predecessor, but I'd like to say... I'm really going to miss you, Art.
Actually,
you're a human being.
Thank you. He's going to be my successor. I'm not sure who my predecessor was. It might be Long John Neville.
Successor.
Art, I want to say thank you so very much for giving me the opportunity to come out from behind the rock to tell my truth, and for giving me the opportunity to do this with your listeners. Thank you so very much.
Doctor, thank you. Good luck to you, and Robert, to you as well, both of you, in Japan. You're going to enjoy that.
Yes, and we'll be in touch, Art.
All right. You too, take care.
Thank you.
You too.
Good night. All right. There you have it. That's Dr. Jonathan Reed and Robert Waite with the most controversial alien encounter story. Pictures to go with on my website right now, in modern times, from the high desert. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
When life throws you lemons, make lemonade.
sounds good, right? But to see someone actually do it, that's awesome. Like when our company started downsizing. Disaster, most of us thought. Just the shove I needed, said Pete. Been wanting to start my own business. Plenty of room for you guys, too. That's Pete. In the crack of doom, he hears opportunity knocking and opened the door for all of us. Sure glad he did.
Just a little food for thought and action from the people of the United Methodist Church.
Hi, this is Tricia Yearwood with today's Eco Quiz. Curbside recycling programs, they've increased tenfold since 1988. And what's even better, more and more of us are using them to recycle steel food cans and plastic soda bottles, among other things. Do you know which of these containers can be recycled over and over again? Here's the answer to today's Eco Quiz. If you said steel food cans, you're right. They not only can be recycled, they can be recycled over and over again, saving substantial amounts of energy and natural resources. Almost everything you recycle helps save some natural resources, as well as landfill space. Did you know that one ton of new paper made from the newspapers you drop off at curbside recycling programs saves enough energy to heat your house for a half year? So recycle and buy recycled. It can help us all. This is Tricia Yearwood on Eco Quiz.
Eco Quiz is a public service of the National Recycling Coalition and the Steel Recycling Institute for a more environmentally conscious America.
Daddy, I can't sleep. Can you please read me a story?
Daddy, get up in a couple of hours. Ask Mom.
Mommy?
Huh?
Could Daddy please read me a story?
Family, isn't it about time?
And the little bear...
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
USA Radio Member News, I'm Jason Walker. Hundreds of mourners have lit candles in Littleton, Colorado in a vigil at a park next to Columbine High School, all part of a day-long series of memorials from the first anniversary of the massacre. Columbine student Brooks Brown says that he doesn't think many kids are coping with the anniversary.
Probably the best way people heal is actually deal with the fact that it happened. Don't hide Columbine underneath fake tiles like they did. Don't change the school colors slightly around inside and expect people to not think of the same place. And I'm all for whatever the families do because, you know, they're the ones that lost kids.
Brooks' father, Randy, says he's still very upset with local law enforcement officials who haven't released a final police report on that shooting rampage.
It's frustrating to me, but it's really criminal when you look at the victims' families and what they've been through and that they should have this information and possibly so they can sue the Sheriff's Department for not doing the job, and yet the Sheriff's Department won't give them the information so they can do that. So it's been one lie after another from the Sheriff's Department, so it's disappointing.
In the meantime, the Columbine tragedy has drawn both presidential candidates deeper into the gun control fray. George W. Bush is calling for a stricter enforcement of the current gun laws on the books. Vice President Al Gore says more needs to be done to get guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. This is USA Radio News.
Are you concerned about interest rates moving up just like they did before the 29 and 87 crashes? Does an overvalued stock market, the rising inflation rate, and an overinflated paper dollar concern you even more? If so, then call the Gold Investment Group now for your free disaster insurance gold investment kit at 1-800-721-3247. That's 1-800-721-3247. With interest rates poised to start moving up and the stock market becoming more vulnerable to a crash, industry experts are now recommending a major shift from paper investments to gold-backed hard assets. Learn how to transfer IRAs, 401ks, and other retirement plans into a gold-backed IRA while also protecting it from government confiscation. Discover which 10 coins to sell immediately and which 10 coins are poised to move a potential 20 to 40% next year. Call 1-800-721-3247. That's 1-800-721-3247 while this critical information and research kit is still free.
The White House says Israel and Palestinians will resume negotiations later this month. A senior U.S. official says the United States will take on a, quote, more intensified role at the request of both sides. And President Clinton says he's willing to assist.
There are risks and difficulties involved,
for Chairman Arafat. There are risks and difficulties involved for Prime Minister Barak, for the Palestinian people, and for the Israeli people. I believe they are not nearly as great as the risks and difficulties of not making a peace agreement, so I hope they will do it. And if they want to do it, I'll do whatever I can to help them.
The president met with PLO chief Yasser Arafat Thursday night for talks at the White House. Well, the government of Yemen is very angry and calling on all Arab nations to boycott the Hollywood hit movie, Rules of Engagement. The movie includes scenes in which Yemenis shoot at Marines at the U.S. Embassy and Marines return fire. Yemen calls the film a racist attack against Arabs. This is USA Radio News.
Are your children off to college soon? Where will you get the money? Well, there's billions in financial aid waiting to be claimed, and you'll find it in Prentice Hall's The Scholarship Book. Over 400 pages of information on more than 100,000 scholarships. Find out who has them, what they're worth, and how to get them. Get the inside track to billions in scholarships with The Scholarship Book. A special hardcover edition is just $26.97 plus shipping. Call 800-852-2800 now. That's 800-852-2800.
Michael the gorilla is dead. He was just one of two gorillas worldwide who had learned human sign language. His handlers in Woodside, California say that Michael knew about 500 gestures in American Sign Language. He was 27 years old, and preliminary autopsy reports show that he died of a heart condition.
It appears that the cause of death is fibrosing cardiomyopathy, which apparently is sort of a hardening of the heart walls, unknown cause. It's similar to, we hear reports of, you know, young, in their prime athletes sort of dropping dead suddenly on the basketball court.
Kevin Connolly, a spokesman with the Gorilla Foundation. On Wall Street Thursday, Dow Industrials up 169 points, NASDAQ lost 62. For the week, the Dow gained 538 points, while the NASDAQ was up 322. There will be no trading on Wall Street on Good Friday. Jason Walker with news on the USA Radio Network.
When I think back on it, that was one of the scariest days of my life. But the day I went to the doctor and discovered I was going blind was even scarier. Retinal degenerative disease affects millions, young and old. Diseases such as retinitis pigmentosa and macular degeneration. If you or a loved one are affected by a retinal degenerative disease, contact the Foundation Fighting Blindness at 1-800-394-8280. It takes vision to find a cure. Call 1-800-394-8280 for free information.
Remember all the gifts you've given your children over the years? Where are those gifts now? Just think, if you had given your child as little as $25 a month in U.S. savings bonds over the last 18 years, he could have $10,000 right now. But you didn't, did you? Give your children a real head start in life. Give them U.S. savings bonds. U.S. savings bonds, the gift of a lifetime. Buy them where you work or bank.
In the Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903.
Warning, everybody, and this is a warning for you. We are about to enter the world of witchcraft. It is at once a light and a dark world. And so if this kind of thing disturbs you or you have children in the room, get them out. It's optional listening. This is real witchcraft we're talking about with a real witch. She is Dr. Evelyn Paglini, and she is the real McCoy. And she's my guest tonight, my main guest tonight. She'll be coming up shortly. I've got a couple of little things, one little thing I'd like to get on the air that's completely unconnected, so it'll give you an opportunity to get disconnected if you can't bear to hear about witchcraft. But this is kind of a cute little fax that somebody sent me that I kind of treasure. You know, I'm moving toward retirement here, and all my life I've been into radio, specifically ham radio and then broadcasting for all my adult life, as you know. And I got a fax from Charles, I will only use his first name here, who writes the following. When I was a little boy, I was always interested in ham radio. This was mainly because my father was a ham radio operator. By the way, there's a new movie out, I'm adding this, called Frequency, about a ham radio operator contacting. And the reviews of it that I'm getting are fantastic. I have not yet had an opportunity to see it. Anyway, Charles goes on. Because my dad was a ham radio operator, and he shared this love of his with me. He got his license back in 1948, the year I was born. I would have loved to follow in his footsteps, but always seemed to have trouble remembering that damn Morse code. Many a night, I'd lie in my dark bedroom, where the only light in the room would be from the dial of the Hallicrafter's S-38 receiver he'd given me. Listening to long-distance broadcasts like Cousin Brucey from New York, we lived on the coast in Massachusetts. My father's ham shack was a renovated linen closet in the hallway next to the bathroom. It had just enough room for his equipment and himself. He could close the door behind him and shut out the noises from the house, the variety of antenna in the backyard, which I'd helped him to install by scrambling across the roof like a squirrel, something I've done frequently, often provoked quite a bit of curiosity from neighbors and many of my childhood friends. Well, being the little mischievous kid that I was and still am, by the way, I could not help but use this curiosity in my favor. Remember now, this was during the McCarthy era, when everyone was afraid the guy next door was a Russian spy, a communist. So I would often invite my friends over on the weekends to play, and conversation would somehow inevitably lead to questions about what was all that stuff in the backyard, referring, of course, to the antenna farm. Naturally, I would reply, "You best not tell anyone, but my father is a Russian spy. He talks to submarines out in the bay. Now, don't tell this to anyone, because people have disappeared knowing this kind of information." And the response was always, "Yeah, right, you are." The stage was set. I knew my dad was in the closet, engrossed in conversation with his ham buddies. At this point, I would lead my unsuspecting young friend into the house, simply quietly open the door to the ham shack, and there my father would be, obviously surprised by the invasion, but the poor kid would even be more surprised seeing this man in headphones sitting beside an enormous amount of equipment in what had appeared to be a linen closet. This would send them running for their lives from the house. Needless to say, I did not have a lot of long-lasting friendships back then, and several of our neighbors moved away. I always wondered about that. And he goes on in the latter part of the fax to offer me the S-38, which is so kind of you, sir, but I would not take a family treasure. I had my own S-38 one day long ago, a receiver, Hallicrafter's. And I would never, ever do that, and your offer is very kind, but what you have is a family treasure, and you should keep it. And I thought that story was kind of cute, so I'd pass it along. Coming up in a moment, we enter a different kind of realm, that of witchcraft. Stay right there. Would you like to look and feel 10 years younger in 10 weeks. Now there's proof that aging can be slowed down, even reversed, with HGH, human growth hormone. You've heard me talk several times about the incredible age-reversing benefits of HGH. According to thousands of studies, HGH levels can help you look and feel younger. That's why I take Ultimate HGH, a natural formula to help boost your body's own production of HGH, designed from the research in the book 10 Weeks to a Younger You by Dr. Klatz. If your goal is to help improve energy, stamina, lose unwanted fat, diminish wrinkles, enhance memory, immune function, and vision, then Ultimate HGH is for you too. And when you order two bottles of Ultimate HGH, you get a third absolutely free, only about $33 a month. It's a tremendous savings off the typical $100 a month for comparable products. Plus, you'll receive the amazing book, 10 Weeks to a Younger You by Dr. Klatz. A $20 value, free. So call now, 1-800-557-4627. That's 1-800-557-4627. 1-800-557-4627.
Goodyear has a deal you can take to the bank. Hurry in for the Goodyear Spring Tire Sale now through May 6th and get a $150 U.S. savings bond when you buy a set of four selected Goodyear tires. Plus, get big savings on Goodyear's most popular passenger, performance, and light truck tires. Hurry, the sale ends May 6th. Stop by a Goodyear and Gemini location for complete details or call 1-800-GOODYEAR for a retailer near you.
There is freedom. Goodyear, Goodyear.
Making too many trips to the bathroom? If so, you're not alone. Millions of men are suffering from enlarged prostate symptoms such as frequent trips to the bathroom and diminished libido. I'd like to tell you about Dr. Toplisky's Super Prostate Formula for enlarged prostate. Dr. Toplisky is one of my favorite medical doctors who developed the formula for his own patients and has used it in his practice for years. I've got to tell you, the results have been astounding. It contains just about every known natural ingredient that's been clinically proven to reduce the size of the prostate and help relieve those uncomfortable symptoms. Super Prostate Formula can definitely help those men suffering enlarged prostates. Therefore, I want you to take advantage of the doctor's special offer. When you order two bottles of Super Prostate Formula, you'll get a third free, a three-month supply for the price of two plus. You'll also get the audio cassette, Complete Guide to Prostate Health by Dr. Toplisky, a $20 value, absolutely free. So, call now, 1-800-472-5151. That's 1-800-472-5151. 1-800-472-5151. You were warned. Here comes Dr. Evelyn Paglini, a witch, a parapsychologist, an authority on the occult and the supernatural, born into a centuries-old family of practitioners of the occult and natural magic. Psychic, metaphysical teacher, lecturer, consultant, doctor of divinity. In 1972, she founded the International Psychic Center, a research investigation organization. She set precedent in the Texas court system on a child abuse case with ritual overtones, worked with law enforcement on missing persons and murder cases involving the occult and the supernatural. Here is Dr. Evelyn Paglini. Evelyn, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to do a show with you.
Oh, it's great to do a show with you, particularly in these final days. You're one of the people that I just had to have back.
Well, thank you, honey.
Geez.
You are the best.
You're very kind. Thank you. So many places that we need to go tonight, but I've always been pretty square with my audience, and I'm going to be pretty square with them and you right now. My father is dying of cancer. He's in the final stages of that.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I talked to him, and I've talked to him, and we'll talk to him, and we'll visit him shortly. And I said, Dad, you know, I've been doing this show for years and years and years now, and the only thing that I think that I've concluded
And I'm not sure about the Bible and God. It may well be exactly as written. The only thing that I'm certain about from interviewing all of the people that I've interviewed, including all the NDE experiencers and people like yourself and so many others, is that there is a consciousness, there is a continuation of who you are and what you are. Energy does not die, and you will not. And that's what I told him, and I'm going to talk to him more about that. But I'm certain of that, Evelyn, that there is a continuance. What do you say?
Absolutely. There is a continuance. All it is that we remove the coat or the shell, but the essence or the spirit of the person, the soul of the person, continues on and sometimes can make a visit.
Yes. It's interesting that you would mention that. There is, right now, in Las Vegas, something that is running on Court TV, so the national audience may or may not know something about it. But it's a big trial here in Las Vegas, a big, big trial, the Ted Binion murder trial. And it is alleged that his girlfriend, along with somebody else, murdered him. And the trial is ongoing, and every day, you know, it's on Court TV, kind of like the OJ thing was. Yesterday, there was a group of top psychics that got together in Las Vegas and attempted to contact Ted Binion, or the spirit of Ted Binion, now departed. They used tarot cards. These really were the top psychics. They unfortunately did not have a picture of Ted Binion. They used one of Benny Binion, his father. And they claimed they were unable to contact Ted. And they used the picture of his father, and I thought that was probably a mistake, was it?
Absolutely. First of all, I'm surprised that they would use the tarot cards. I would definitely make sure that I had a picture, a fairly recent picture of the deceased person. I would also acquire articles of clothing, a wallet, keychain, watch, anything that you can tap into the vibration of the spirit and the energy of that spirit. So I can understand why they didn't make contact, and they cannot reach him through the father.
They are going to try again. So an appropriate picture would be good, and I thought maybe a little black tar incense.
Yes, that would help too.
Yeah, you know, Ted's up there, he probably
the essence
goes,
of what he was.
Yeah, the essence of what he was. Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, in cases where spirits of the departed are successfully contacted, in what manner does the departed one manifest?
Well, it depends on their energy. Now, they can at times manifest in spirit form. They can, in rare occasions, use an ectoplasm, which will give them even more solidity and outline of themselves. But most spirits are going to, first of all, either give you a scent or an aroma that is associated with them, or what they can do also is naturally make noise, make changes, put, let's say, television, radios on and off. They can move objects. They can touch you. They can caress you.
Evelyn, have you seen that occur? For example, a very graphic demonstration to me would be an object moving or moving into the air, something of that sort.
I have very much witnessed that and then some. In fact, I can tell you a story about a case I got involved with where a woman had bought a parcel of land from an estate, the largest estate in Atlanta, Georgia. And being an architect, she built her own mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And right after she moved in, she started to have the spirit coming to her of a small child, a beautiful little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl of about maybe 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
And this child would beckon her. And what she would do is try to follow it. Now, because the house was so big, it had an east wing and a west wing, when the child would beckon her to go into these other rooms, as she would go from room to room, it seemed like the room would get colder and she would get more uneasy. Mm-hmm. What it was doing was leading her down toward the end of the hall of the east wing where there was one particular door and room. But fortunately, she didn't go there because she just got stopped, blocked. In other words, she almost had revulsion. She called me in, and when I got there, the moment I walked in the door, I felt a presence. But the presence that I felt was a little bit more malefic, not a youngster that was, you know, innocent and playing.
Yes.
When I proceeded to see the child and follow it from room to room, and I got toward the last room and I opened up the door, the child disappeared, and in its place came the form of a demon. And this demon, I'm talking about something that stood about 7.5 feet tall.
Oh, brother.
And you want to talk about those terrible eyes that you hate, the red glowing eyes?
Those are
the ones. Let me tell you, this one had it. What it was, after I found out and made touch with it, and at first I put up a shield of protection, what it was that this estate was used by a society or a fraternity where they were sacrificing children
to
this deity. And I won't mention the deity because I don't want to send some people out and try to
call it up.
But that's what they were doing. They were paying homage, doing a summation and an evocation to this deity. And what this deity was doing was looking for, again, followers and looking to possess any person that lived within the premises.
Now, the people that were calling this evil entity forward,
mm-hmm.
and I understand how doors open, so I understand how that door opened, but what were they trying to gain?
This particular demon is known for giving wealth and longevity.
Oh.
And so it is sought after, and it has been sought after for several hundreds of years. And this is a very well-known entity. Very well known. Anybody that's into ceremonial magic knows this entity.
Can you safely really do a seance and be sure of what you're going to get?
If you're a professional and you put up a shield of protection for every person in that room as well as yourself, if you set up the rules, then you can. But understand, if you are having novices there, a spirit or an entity is going to take all of the energy within the room as well as all of the energy from the people that are present, and they will choose one person in order to use their bodily functions and their vocal cords in order to make contact. It could be very frightening.
That
could be, you know.
If it'd be a regular heart tester for me. I don't know that I could handle that. If a spirit of a loved one comes, that's one thing. If you have an encounter with a kind of entity that you did, that's something else entirely. I'm not sure I lived through that one.
It's very difficult. But so spirits and entities are not always malefic. Please understand, a lot of our loved ones will come back, sometimes to give us a warning, sometimes to protect us, to guide us.
But there must be a realm, Evelyn, not knowing what's on the other side of this veil, where human spirits departed and entities of the kind you have spoken about, as well as no doubt a lesser and greater ones, exist.
Absolutely.
And this realm, it must be some sort of shared realm. In other words, once you open the door, you could get any of the above.
Absolutely, because there are dimensions. And so, therefore, once you have swung open the door, you are allowing any dimension in. So you can get a discarnate entity. You can get an entity that has been conjured, in other words, created. Or you might get a supernatural being, one that has never held human form. And what it wants to do is walk the land.
Walk the land?
Absolutely.
In other words, it cannot do so until it is
given permission and a body.
Given permission and a body.
Yeah. And see, most practitioners that are into high magic, that is what they are going to do in order to get the goodies that have been promised to them by this particular entity.
So, magic
Evelyn, is real.
Magic has been real for tens of thousands of years, and it is in every culture and in every religion.
That's
just
true.
Like most of them, they have also done sacrifice. Animal or human.
Or human. That's something we touched on in the last program we did.
Yes.
This human sacrifice thing is real, isn't it?
It is still going on today, and it's not just the Jamaican or the Haitian or the South African voodoo. It's not just Santeria, but it is in other cultures and in other religions, and it's still very prevalent.
All right. Evelyn, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest is a real witch. She may object to that term. I don't know. We'll talk about that. She's Evelyn Paglini, very well known, very much the real thing. You would do well to sit tight, buckle in, and listen.
Weird stuff on the radio. Art Bell wrote the book. Actually, Art really did write the book. His bestseller, Thought Quickening. Art's also behind one of the hottest websites on the internet, artbell.com. It should come as no surprise to you that Art Bell has a radical newsletter as well. It's called After Dark. It's not the internet. It's not on newsstand. It's not to be missed. To subscribe, call 1-888-727-5505. After Dark is chock full of beautiful color photos, detailed articles on the very subjects that fascinate Art, and articles written by who else but Art. A one-year subscription is only $39.95 for 12 monthly issues. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. Weird never looked this good. Call right now, 1-888-727-5505. It's called After Dark.
It's the top of the month, the bills are due. The mail carrier slings on her bag and delivers the mail. Mr. Jones tears open his envelope, finds his federal government payment, and he's off. He's in his car and cruising down the road. He weaves left, sags right. He's inside, endorsing his check. He's stuck in a line.
Avoid the hassle. Sign up for direct deposit.
Walls and come through ceilings, but to get a photograph of it. This one's really creepy, folks. All right, here we go. First time caller line, you are first on Ghost to Ghost this night. Hello.
Hey, Art.
Hey.
How you doing?
Okay, where are you?
I am calling from Chicago, WLS.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well, I was doing an antique show in Texas, and on the way back, I went to visit my sister's house. It was in St. Bernard Parish, right outside of New Orleans.
Right.
And so she was taking me on like a tour that most people don't go on, showing the interesting stuff. And she goes, oh, I got to show you this. I got to show you this. It's the LeBeau Plantation House. We drove by it, and it's owned by a fairly famous sugar company. Any grocery store that you would go into, you'd see the sugar packages. So they ended up buying up this plantation and the property next.
Right.
And it's all boarded up. Place looks real spooky and everything like that. She starts telling me the stories about this, and the first thing that I said after she started telling me this is, we have got to go in there. We've got. And she started laughing, going, ever since I moved here, I've been waiting for you to get down here because I've been wanting to sneak in.
So in other words, you would intentionally go into such an environment?
As crazy as it sounds.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, fine. So you and who went?
Me, my sister, and my wife. Now, we're all adults, but we're all kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. All right.
So a couple days later, it rained for a couple nights, so we couldn't do it. But a few days later, we got some good weather, and we were armed with a towel and a flashlight.
That's good armor. Yes, towel and a flashlight, yes.
And it's funny because the people that live around here, if they're listening to the show, they'll know exactly what we're talking about. I should probably tell you the history of this place first.
Well, I'd rather just kind of get to what happened.
Okay. Well, We sneak it. We go behind VFW Hall, which is back behind this place, and we got to go a roundabout way to sneak over the fence and this, that, and the other. And it's kind of like right out of an X-Files episode, you know, going through sugar tankards in the middle of the night, standing too high and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Get into the house, finally. And I'd like to say that we didn't really destroy anything except like a little 8-inch board trying to get in. But we get into this place, and it's huge. And there's like 8 rooms on the bottom floor. And so we start making our way around, and we're looking for a staircase. And you have to imagine that we're not supposed to be there.
I understand that you did this voluntarily. So anyway,
well, and also we're trespassing, and you know, yeah. so we're more afraid of security than we are of ghosts.
All right, you know? I've got the picture.
And so one of the first things that happened, and this was really bizarre, okay, because, you know, I'm pointing the flashlight down at the ground, I'm using the towel to kind of, like, block out the light so we're not lighting up an entire room at a time, but only only a little bit so that we're not going to be seen from the outside.
Yes.
And now, my wife and my sister saw this better than I did. I saw it out of the corner of my eye, but they saw it.
Just tell me what happened.
A flashing light shot across the room, but in like a swooping motion going upwards and then down and then back up again.
Like in Ghostbusters.
Yeah, it just shot across. Now, I only saw it out of the corner of my eye, and they saw it, so I turned out the flashlight because I'm thinking somebody's, you know, security's coming, they're flashing a light, everything.
Oh, yeah, sure. First you
and
like that.
So we're like, shh, be quiet, be quiet, be quiet. And we go stand by the doors and we're looking out. The doors are boarded up, but, you know, there's places where you can see out, and we're looking to see. And we're like 300-400 yards from in any direction from anything.
And
so we're just standing there being quiet. And then my sister goes, I just saw a light up in through the floorboards in the ceiling above us. She goes, I just saw a light up there. I went, get out. And I'm looking up, and then I see it in a different place. And there's like light coming through the floorboards, but yet there's like big holes here and there, and the holes weren't illuminated at all. Just little cracks of light. I mean,
not really, coming from everywhere. Okay, I get it. Yeah.
Really, really bizarre. Okay, so then we go on, and I'm like, nah, because you know, you're sitting there, you're saying none of this is happening. You know, you're just paranoid and all this stuff. And so we go walking.
Got about 30 seconds, sir.
I'm sorry. We go around to the. We make the first pass of the first floor, and then we notice that we couldn't find the staircase. So we start going through again. The second time through, this is the weirdest thing. We heard, I mean, this is like, it sounds like a classic haunting type of thing, but I swear it sounded like, you know, like a large metal-handled door and something swinging closed.
Yes.
The wind started blowing, and everything's boarded up. But, and it dropped, like, we could hear wind outside, but it dropped like 20 degrees. And everybody just freaked, because we thought we were busted. Not that there were ghosts or anything.
Okay,
like.
We're at about the end of the time here.
Oh, that's a shame, because it gets better.
Well, it's going to have to do it real quick.
Well, basically, I go over by the end-all, be-all, is we heard what sounded like the voices of, like, slaves. Calling like adult black men calling to
and where
like,
where was this again, please?
This is in St. Bernard Parish, the Lobo Plantation House.
All right, there was a slave route when I lived in Maryland once, a place called Blue Ridge Summit. We lived in a very large house at the time. In fact, the house we lived in, my mom called it early Victorian Halloween, early Halloween. It was an old house, but it had 35 rooms. 35 rooms. And I, of course, had appropriated one of the top rooms in the house for my ham shack. And it was on a route where they had sent slaves, you know, and they would send slaves from the southern part of the country to the northern part of the country. And there were certain, like, safe houses for the slaves, and this was one of them. And so we had, in this house, it was a creepy house that I lived in. We had secret passageways. And so it was really cool as a child because, man, there were secret passageways that went around almost every room in the house. Totally secret passageways. Now, the story was they had been used to hide slaves in their trek north, you know, would be a stopping off point. But, man, that was one weird house I lived in. A place called Blue Ridge Summit, Pennsylvania, Maryland. The Mason-Dixon line actually ran right through the house. Actually ran through the house. Amazing. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Yeah, this is Pat from Southwest Florida.
Yes, Pat.
I'm a retired New York City fireman, fire lieutenant.
New York City fire lieutenant, okay.
That's correct, yeah.
Yes, sir.
And this concerns a story regarding a ghost story that I heard. This is not a first-hand story, but this was about Rescue 1, which at the time was on 43rd Street between 8th and 9th Avenue.
Uh-huh.
And the story was related to me by a firefighter at the time. This is about 1977. Can't remember the guy's last name. The first name is Chris. And if he's listening, he comes from Glen Cove, Long Island.
Okay.
But at any rate, he told me this story that on the second floor of this particular firehouse on 43rd Street, Rescue 1, it's the bunk room. You know, on the first floor, you have your fire truck and the kitchen and what have you.
Sure.
On the second floor, you have the bunk room. And he said that one night he went up there between about 2:15 in the morning, and he, you know, between runs, you know, you can go into the bed, you know.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Sure.
Lieutenant, in those firehouses, you know, the old-fashioned thing was that there was this sliding pole between one floor and another, and you would see firemen sliding down it. Did that exist?
Oh, sure, of course.
Really?
Of course, yeah. They had two of them in each house. In this particular house, they had two, one up front and one in the back.
I always wondered if that was real normal or just sort of a media thing, you know?
Oh, no, that's absolutely true.
It's okay, all right.
Absolutely true.
Yeah, okay.
And if there any New York City fireman, or any fireman, I suppose, for that matter, they would certainly know this, you know?
Okay.
At the time, I was assigned to Fort Truck, which was on 48th and 8th, 48th Street and 8th Avenue. Anyway, he told me this story, and he said that this one particular night, he went up to into the bed, and he was lying on his stomach. And by the way, this particular bunk room is extremely dark, or it was extremely dark.
Right.
Pitch black. I mean, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face, and the only thing you could see was the luminescent light up on the wall, and he looked up and he saw it was about 3 o'clock or so, something like that. And then all of a sudden he felt a pressure on his ankles, like somebody grabbing his ankles.
Oh.
You know?
Yes.
And then they moved up towards his calves and so on and so forth, you know?
Uh-huh.
And he thought maybe it was one of the guys just, you know, playing a trick or, you know, goofing on him, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, when the guy got up to the back of his thighs, he said, "That's it. I'm not putting up with this."
Right.
And he jumped up and he turned on the lights in the bunk room, which was pitch black. And there was absolutely nobody there. And everybody else was fast asleep.
Yeah, well, this is part of what I've never understood and part of what I was after tonight. If, you know, I can understand that there could be a ghost or there could be an entity of some sort, but how they actually physically manifest in this world and attack people and do things like you're talking about, that one I don't get.
Well, I saw this guy twice afterwards, and I said, "Chris, I said, were you telling me the truth about that story?"
Right.
And he said, "I absolutely was. But let me tell you one, let me go a little further with this."
Sure.
Okay? So the next morning, he got up and he related the story to the lieutenant on duty that morning.
Right.
And he said, "Hey, you know, something happened last night. It was really weird." And they checked the records, and it turns out that something like 20 years before, like 19...
A boomerang, you set up the mirrors, you encircle yourself in flames, and you put up a shield of protection. Once that is done, now you can find out what aspect of your life has been, you know, changed, if it's financial or emotional or health or love, and then you can do an attraction or a balancing ritual.
Suppose I were to come to you and I said, look, Evelyn, 20 years now, my life is ruined, my marriage is broken, I'm devastated, nothing I do in business has worked, everything has failed. I'm not sure if it's me in bad luck or if there's really a psychic attack going on. How do you delineate? How do you find out? If somebody comes to you with a story like that, how do you find out whether they're under attack?
Well, first of all, you're going to use psychometry to tap into either a picture, an article of clothing of the individual, and it has a vibration. That vibration will make the hair on your head stand on end, the back of the nape of your neck. The hair will stand on and you feel it.
So there's no question about it.
No question about it. And then what you do is you proceed in removing it and, again, putting a shield of protection so that it is impenetrable, so that somebody isn't going to come back and put it on you again.
Do a lot of people come to you in that condition, Evelyn?
Since I have been on your show, let's just talk about the last few years.
Sure.
I have had, on the average, of between 600 and 1,000 email after I do a show, and maybe 2,000 to 3,000 in mail. And I would have to say 70 to 75% are people who are being affected by other practitioners in one aspect of their life, if not another. That's common.
Evelyn, we have 260 million people in America.
Yes.
How many do you think are out there engaging in the practice?
25 years ago, I would have said that there might have been maybe 20%. I would have to say today it's more like 60, maybe even better than that. We are into the Great Awakening. And so people are feeling an urge and a desire to get into nature and the elements. Even some of them don't understand why, but they're being drawn in that direction.
Yes, I know.
Others realize that there is a power and a control there. And so they're going into it for the purpose of subjugating other individuals and instilling fear, as well as gaining their own purposes and their own goals.
So if there really are that many, or even half that many out there, and you are one of the ones who has no knowledge about this, doesn't know about this, you're really at a great handicap, aren't you?
Very much so. Most people don't believe it can be done. So again, they're not protected. And if they do talk to someone, who's going to believe them? And then where would you go in order to find somebody that's going to help you? You have to be careful, Art, because there's an awful lot of chicanery.
I hear that.
There's a lot of charlatanism.
I hear that, too.
You got people who say, give me $5,000. You know, I'm going to burn it in front of you, and then all of your problems are going to be, you know, dispelled and dismissed. Not a chance.
Evelyn, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. My guest is a practitioner of natural magic, if you will, Dr. Evelyn Paglini. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
I sang in public for the first time when I was in ninth grade. They had a little variety show, and I listened to a lot of Carole King. And so I just started playing guitar, and I sat at the edge of the stage and sang about three songs.
A modest beginning for one of today's most popular songwriters and singers. This is Passages. I'm Dennis Benson. Kathy had the school solidly behind her.
I had a big billboard and a sign that said Kathy Sings King, and after that I started being asked in rock bands and stuff. I remember being in my room one day and my mom came in and heard me and she said, would you sing that again? And so my parents encouraged me a lot.
Kathy also had other significant adults who affirmed her.
And also it was a teacher that I was really close with. Kept on saying, you know, you really should sing. Get in the show and sing. And I would be like, I don't know how to sing in front of people. And she said, just try it. It took a lot of encouragement from people, but once I started doing it, I loved it.
Please encourage young artists in your community. Kathy's story is a challenge from your Presbyterian and United Methodist friends.
I am a child.
I'm made of skin and bones.
I'm made of muscle.
Eyes, nose, ears.
We are your children.
We are made of many things.
Every piece is special.
I'm made of body and soul.
The soul.
My imagination.
Intelligence.
All made of skin and bones. I'm proud of my feelings.
Forgiveness.
Aspiration
and dreams.
I am made of confidence and pride.
Confidence and self-esteem.
What's inside me? Love.
Honesty.
And truth.
Knowledge. Purity. Dreams.
My fears.
I am made of skin and bones. We are made of many things. Every piece is special.
Please.
Thank you all you can protect us.
Call Prevent Child Abuse America.
1-800-CHILDREN.
That's 1-800-CHILDREN.
I am a child.
I am strong.
Smart.
Powerful.
So what are you made of?
Won't you help me?
For more information, call 1-800-CHILDREN. A public service message brought to you by Prevent Child Abuse America, the Ad Council, and this station.
Radio Network News, I'm Jason Walker. The Leon Gonzalez saga continues. USA's Connie Lawn has the latest.
President Clinton says he knows of no conceivable argument for preventing Leon Gonzalez and his father from being reunited. The president said the ruling by the three-judge panel in Atlanta does not deny a father-son reunion. He noted the main argument of the family in Miami was that the father might take his son back to Cuba. Now the court has prevented that, so a meeting should take place. Connie Lawn, USA Radio News, Washington.
In the meantime, a published report now says Janet Reno may be ready to make a major move. Time for the middle.